I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hi friends, this is Alex from Look Mum No Hands. You won't hear from me in this episode. I'm just your stoker, stoking up the rear of our captain, Jenny from the London Bike Kitchen. She was in California while on holidays over Christmas, and she had an opportunity to go to the Mara Museum of Bicycling and the Mountain Biking Hall of Fame. So please enjoy Jenny finding out more about the history of the bicycle, the story of the museum, and some of the people behind it.
My name is Connie Thorpe Breeze, and we are at the Marin Museum of Bicycling and Mountain Bike Hall of Fame in Fairfax, which is in Marin County, California.
What's the history behind the museum? How did you guys get here, and has it always been the Museum of Bicycling plus the Hall of Fame, or tell me more about that?
Okay. Well, having a Museum of Bicycling is a dream that Joe Breeze, my husband, has had for probably 40 years or so. We both grew up in Mill Valley, a town near here, and everyone of around our age at that time remembers Joe as the guy who was just trying in every way he could to turn people onto cycling, because he felt at the time, especially in this country, cycling was like a secret. Very few people were riding bikes, and he knew how amazing they are for, well, he had become a bike racer, but for getting around town, for feeling healthy, getting the places you want to go, for the joy it brings when you pedal and you go flying along, all of that. He knew the bicycles had so much to offer for the environment and for communities and for individuals, for their own health and all that.
They're anyway, the magic formula for curing the of society's ills?
Yes. I don't know. They're the answer to so many things.
They answer everything.
They do. Yes, there's hardly anything they don't answer. And one of the things Joe felt when he was racing and he was working on bikes, early on he hadn't yet become a frame builder, but he had been learning about bicycle history, and especially that 19th century history when the bicycle was the vehicle and all the top engineers of the day were working on perfecting the bicycle and doing just beautiful workmanship on bicycles. The 19th century bikes, especially Golden Age bikes, are just extraordinarily beautiful. And he felt that if he could collect some old bikes, early beautiful bikes, restore them and just put them places where people could see them, you know, put them in shopping malls or whatever, that people would appreciate the bicycle more because they'd say, wow, isn't that extraordinary? And so it was actually a search for, that ongoing search for old bikes that led Joe to the mountain bike. Because he was looking, it was when he was looking for gorgeous old 19th century bikes that they came across old clunkers, old Schwinn type,
these
fat tire bikes. That's right.
Us.
Yes, yeah. But anyway, that idea of sharing cycling with the public to appreciate, make them appreciate cycling more, is that very long held dream. And the idea behind the museum really is that the more people know the history of cycling, the better its future.
As with most things.
That's right. The better informed people are, the better off we are, right? In general. It is so, that's clear all around us every day.
So you've got a really amazing collection of old bikes here.
Yes.
Can you tell me more about them?
I'll give you a brief synopsis. Yeah. Joe is amazing at showing these bikes because he is the curator. But basically, on this, the deck that Jenny and I are looking at here, we start with a bike from the 1860s when the bicycle was wrought iron and wood. We covered a short period of about 30 years in which the bicycle then developed into what looks like a gorgeous modern fixie.
And but
they were indeed. It's an 1894 Columbia, but it's just strikingly beautiful in a modern way because the basic elements of the bicycle had all been put together in that period of time.
I'm curious about this bike here, the tricycle. Mm-hmm. Was that aimed at women?
Well, when in this period that we're talking about, when the bicycle was being developed, there were no givens, and people were working on two and three and four-wheeled vehicles, and tricycles were being developed extensively in the period of the high wheeler, and a lot of men rode tricycles as well. In these earlier periods, there was a lot of tricycle racing and touring and so forth.
Cool.
But yes, because women in the, like, say, the 1870s, 80s, that's the main period of the high wheeler, women were wearing clothing that, since you can't ride a bike side saddle, women's clothing kept them from being able to sit astride a high wheel bike, but they could ride a tricycle.
Mm-hmm.
I've never had any doubt that about whether women actually did ride high wheelers, they just had to borrow a guy's clothing.
Mm.
There, you very often see scenes like what we have in the pictures here. Here's a group of men on high wheel bikes. They're on what looks like basically a off-road conditions, riding down a hill, and there's one woman in the group, and she's on a tricycle in her dress.
Respectable.
Mm-hmm.
But you were talking about the kind of the history of the bike and the history of women's rights, women's suffrage.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell me more about what we see here and how it correlates
sure.
with that?
Yes. When in the latter part of the 1880s and the 1890s, the technology of the bicycle had developed to the point where it had gearing and it had two equal-sized wheels and the rider was centered over the frame and was pedaling cranks. At that point, women's clothing was less of a barrier for cycling.
Yeah.
And also the bike boom was just growing and growing. In that period, as the bike boom grew and grew, women just got involved in cycling, and their clothing changed. Separated legs or fairly elaborate leggings that with skirts over them, things like that. There was a thing called rational dress.
Rational dress, yes.
And women found new freedoms on bicycles. The boom eventually became so huge that women were allowed to go out in groups on their own, and they were allowed to go out even cycling with young men. I get the impression that it would be easier for a woman to be allowed to go out on a ride with a young man than it would be for her to go out to dinner with him.
Uh-huh.
Because it was just cycling was a huge thing. And the manufacturers saw that obviously women are a large part of the market, and they marketed the bicycle to women, and there are a lot there. The history behind that is really fascinating, how the manufacturers made cycling inviting and safe-looking, wholesome, and all of that. They were it was less sophisticated than it is these days, but that's they were doing that. But also, you know, women loved cycling.
Yeah.
That feeling that you get when you sit on a bike and you turn the pedals and the amount of energy that you put into it takes you farther down the road than you might expect to. Imagine how that was back then when no one had, you know, you hadn't done that before and you try it out as an adult and you're just amazed. And it's that feeling of empowerment is pretty clearly connected with more women feeling empowered to help bring about changes. Obviously, there's a great deal more to it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people working very, very hard and finding all kinds of barriers, too. But there's a clear connection. And on this deck, we include a number of contemporary quotes from people of the time about cycling.
Cool. Yeah, let's have a look.
In possession of her bicycle, the daughter of the 19th century feels that the declaration of her independence has been proclaimed, and in the fullness of time, all things will be added to complete her happiness and prosperity. And that's a quote from a women's magazine from April 1896.
I'd love to get a copy of that magazine.
Yes, yeah, you can find these things online. This is a quote from August 1896 by Joseph Bishop, Social and Economic Influence of the Bicycle, in the magazine Forum, which was a general interest magazine. New social laws have been enacted to meet the requirements of the new order. Parents who will not allow their daughters to accompany young men to the theater without chaperonage allow them to go bicycle riding alone with young men. This is considered perfectly proper.
Mm-hmm. So it's a tool for courtship.
Yeah. Susan B. Anthony, one of the most famous women working in women's rights in the 1880s, 90s, I'm not sure her exact period, but anyway, this is an 1896 quote, and she's... A magazine interviewer asked her what she thought about cycling and the bicycle. And she said, "I'll tell you what I think of the bicycle. I think it has done more to emancipate women than any one thing in the world."
I don't disagree. Oh, these bikes are beautiful. Even like the little accessories.
Yeah, the lights. We have a very good book about the history of the lights.
Really?
There would have been very little street lighting in the period, except in towns.
Yeah,
and your roads were rough, too. Mm-hmm. You can see it kind of gets lost on here. But you see where this hub lamp, this is a hub lamp. It's placed right in here on a high wheeler. Because if you put your light way up here, you're not lighting the road surface as well. And these high wheel bikes, kind of amazing to think about it, but most of the time they were ridden on unpaved roads. So if you can light your road surface, it's helpful. We one of our favorite things is to do the research, collect old photos and things. This is
local photos as well.
Yes, exactly. Uh-huh. When you do it around here, you're getting a picture in San Francisco of people in 1868, which is probably the year of this bike, and it was French 1868, but they made it over to San Francisco.
Cool. Yeah. You've got some really nice old bikes, and then you've got across the 20th century.
Yes, so to go back to the history of the museum, why the museum is here, there was this long-held dream to show bikes to the public, and there were a few factors that made it so this museum happened. The nonprofit was founded in 2013, and Joe Brees, Otis Guy, Mark Vendetti, Lena Maria Estrella, and Julia Velich were the main people who were working on putting the nonprofit together so that we could actually have a museum and share the whole range of cycling with people. And the things that happened were that this big, beautiful space that we have, this was the site of a locally run health food store that had moved into this space and beautifully remodeled it and became so successful that they moved into an old supermarket building in another part of town.
Nice.
They needed more space. This had been a sort of, simple small-town grocery store. And so the space was available, and then Joe had guest curated an exhibit at the San Francisco Airport Museum on the history of the mountain bike in Northern California, Northern California's contributions to mountain bike technology.
Cool.
And in doing that, he learned a great deal about how museums were run, and he was doing something that he had so long wanted to be able to do. And that exhibit ran for about 8 months, and then it came down. He had helped arrange the loans of the various bikes and so forth. And when that exhibit came down, the curators there gifted to Joe the backdrops that we see in this room, this tall black and white backdrop that's a photograph from up in the hills here, including various places that are super popular for mountain biking. So having those backdrops meant, maybe we really should do this museum thing.
Yeah, extension.
Yes, and then also the Mountain Bike Hall of Fame, which had been founded in Crested Butte, Colorado, which is a fantastic place, a high mountain town. It's in the Rocky Mountains in Colorado at over 9,000 feet. It's an amazing place for mountain biking and a really cool small town, which in the summer has loads of people coming for cycling, and in the winter, people are coming for skiing. And it's remote. It takes quite
Sounds
a while
like
to get
dream,
to it.
Though.
It is,
like,
yeah.
That's what I want
when you
to
go
do.
There, you never want to leave.
You don't need to leave.
No. You just want, this is where I want to be. The people there had thought of founding a Mountain Bike Hall of Fame way back in 1988 and had been running it all those years as a nonprofit. And they knew that fewer people could come to Crested Butte.
Mm.
and also that Crested Butte is a ski town in the winter. And they were also old friends of all the people here. They'd had many connections going back to the 1980s. And they just, I guess, all got to talking about how if you moved the Mountain Bike Hall of Fame to Marin County, or any place where you have a bigger population coming through, mm-hmm. we're only 20 miles from San Francisco here, then more people can see it, and it's easier to keep it open year-round, too. And so those guys, in founding the nonprofit, they had all these things in mind and just pulled it all together.
So that's the mountain bike side, Mountain Bike Hall of Fame side, yeah? There's also just the Museum of Bicycling.
That's right. We are the Marin Museum of Bicycling. And then within the Marin Museum of Bicycling, we have the Mountain Bike Hall of Fame, which is, it's a collection of bikes involved in mountain bike history, mm-hmm. or many of them. And then it's also, we've become the administrators of the Mountain Bike Hall of Fame, which has been honoring a group of people ever since 1988. People get nominated and voted upon, and numbers of people get elected each year, usually, typically about four. Everything in this museum is a cool design project that everybody works hard at making reality. And what we have here
is the mountain bike wheel.
Yes,
we
have we spin up here. We're going to spin a mountain bike wheel to look at the years and the people inducted in each year, so that you can just spin the wheel and see at a glance who you might be looking for and who's the latest. Our most recent inductees, this is 2017, and they get inducted in the usually late September, early October. We had Giovanna Bonazzi, Brent Foes, Mark Norstadt, and Wolfgang Renner.
Cool.
So, and then we have screens here where you can look up any of these many inductees. There are, I forget, something in the range of 150 now since 1988.
Do people get inducted based on, like, how many races they've won, or also just contributions to mountain biking in general?
It's basically contributions to the sport, mm-hmm. which can be their racing career, it can be their advocacy career, it can be what they've done in journalism. In fact, it used to be in the days when Crested Butte was running the Hall of Fame, they actually had categories for each year, and there'd be nominees within the categories to make sure that it was always spread out that way. We've actually found it tends to sort itself out pretty well anyway, but the process is, well, the people at the museum are not choosing who's coming into the Hall of Fame. There's a process done mostly online where people can think of someone they would like to see in the Hall of Fame, and they do a nomination for them. There's a committee, it's not part of the museum board, but a group of people from various parts of the industry look at all of those and make sure that the nominations are complete and have plenty of information, and that it is someone who's had an impact on the sport, mm-hmm. nationally to internationally, especially these days. We're trying to make sure that the Mountain Bike Hall of Fame is more international, because there was a period at first when it was more American. In 1999...
Hans Rey.
Yes, there you go. A bunch of Europeans, because they, knowing that it should be an international Hall of Fame. They actually went to Europe to do the induction.
Oh, wow.
And really focused on getting European nominations and having the induction ceremony there.
Nice.
Yeah, on the website. You can read more of that details.
We'll post that below so you guys can check it out. And then you had a special visitor?
Probably a couple weeks. We were lucky enough to have Peter Sagan in town. He was just very briefly in town. And what Jenny and I have come over to look at now is one of the bikes that he rode to a world championship. In fact, his first world championship in Richmond, Virginia in 2015. And with a picture of him right here in downtown Fairfax in front of our coffee roastery with the bike. So, yeah, we did just a few of us. It was very short notice, but a few of us had the pleasure of meeting him. Joe and Otis got to do some riding with him for a video shoot, and yeah, it was really awesome. We were just we loved it.
But he wasn't recognized, you said.
That's right. Here in America, cycling is still something of a secret. Not as there are fewer people here who follow road racing or mountain bike racing. And yes, he was able to hang out in downtown Fairfax, and only the cyclists going by, the racing type cyclists, the real roadies who came by, did see who he was. But
he can be anonymous here,
which must be nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we do get visitors from all over the world, and one thing people love is the fact that the bikes that we have in here, especially the mountain bikes, these really are the very bikes involved in the history. Mm-hmm. When you look at these bikes, that's the very bike you saw in a magazine with a certain person riding it. It's if you've read Charlie Kelly's book, Fat Tire Flyer, or read any of his history, then we have one whole wall here where just about every bike on the wall is in that book and is an historic bike.
Amazing. Thank you, Connie, for your time.
It's a pleasure, Jenny. My name is Wendy Cragg.
Why are you here?
Why am I here? I guess you'd like to learn a little bit about my history with the bike and how I got involved with it. There weren't a whole lot of women riding bikes at all back then. When I accidentally, totally by accident, discovered the mountain bike via my neighbor Fred Wolf, who was good friends with Charlie Kelly, who was good friends with Gary Fisher. It was basically an accidental tourist kind of thing.
Yeah.
Happy accident. My first bike weighed 56 pounds.
Oh, God.
It was a J.C. Higgins. It had 5 speeds, and I think it had a drum brake in the rear. It was considered state of the art then, although it weighed almost half my body weight. And my first bike ride was just out on a little single-track trail from my house to Tamarancho, which is where, well, it's a network of great riding now, but back then it wasn't so much. I probably rode a total of 2 miles my first ride, and I hated it. I hated it. It was uncomfortable. I just didn't,
Was that bike, though, designed to be for mountain bike?
Yeah, it was. It was. And I was on dirt, and I guess part of it was I wasn't in good enough shape to appreciate it. But I gradually got talked into getting back in the saddle by my neighbor, Fred, who was into everything nature-related. He knew where all the wildflowers were. He knew where the wildlife was.
Mm-hmm.
And He kind of convinced me that it would be so much easier to get there, to find those things via the mountain bike than hiking, which is
true. Absolutely
true. So he kind of was instrumental in getting me into the mountain bike. And once I got into it, it didn't take that long. Once I had established that I really did like it,
mm-hmm.
and then I got so hooked. I got so hooked. It was like everything that I wanted to be able to do, because I was really into hiking back then, but having the advantage of being able to go twice the distance,
Yeah. It
really opened up a lot of, and especially being a female, it gave me a lot of independence and freedom. And once I became strong enough that I felt secure, and it was a process,
mm-hmm.
not just to get stronger physically, but stronger mentally, that I could feel that I can do this by myself.
Totally.
But there were a lot of great group rides too at the beginning.
How old were you? Like, when were you going out on the weekends? Did you have to go to school?
No, I was about 28, so I was an adult. I was an adult. Fortunately, I didn't have a real job, because it would have interfered with my passion. I was starting a textile business back then,
oh, wow.
So I had sort of a conflict of interest, Am I going to ride my bike? Am I going to sit in my studio and create? And there were actually a couple of times when I thought, I wonder how I can rig up my bike to pull my sewing machine with maybe a little compressor or something. I literally was thinking out of the box, how can I take this out there and combine the two passions that I now
make
have?
Make it like a pedal-powered sewing machine.
Exactly.
Like the pedal-powered knife sharpener, right? The dude who rides around and then he puts the kickstand up and could do that with sewing.
So, yeah, but it kind of did cut into my time, but in a really good way, because it just expanded all my horizons. It was like unlimited, And back then, we had full access to all the trails, all the fire roads, everything. It was just not anymore. It's been closed off for decades. But back in the day, we could spend literally all day riding on the mountain.
Did they close them off because of you?
I think
you guys
it was...
to no good?
The horse people, the equestrians and the hikers, the Sierra Club kind of came down hard, and they didn't like their experience being ruined by a mechanized encounter with a mountain bike. So, yeah, we had a lot of restrictions after that. But in the beginning, for the first 4 or 5 years, we had pretty much the whole everything, all of Marin County. You know, we'd go out and ride on the coast. We'd go all of Mount Tam. We'd do Loma Alta. We'd do things.
Were they just day trips, or did you bring camping equipment?
No, it was all day trips. Yeah.
You took a lot of photos. There's a lot of photos, your photos in Fat Tire Flyer.
Yeah.
And so were you kind of, one day were you like, I'm just going to bring my camera?
Well, actually, I didn't have a camera. I was using my ex-husband's camera, and he was a guitar repairman for the Stars, so he'd go all over the world, and he wanted his own camera, right? Because, I mean, the experience of being, you know, a world traveler, you always have to have a camera. So we ended up getting our own separate cameras, and once I got my own camera, it was always in my backpack. It was always in my backpack. So, you know, the extra film, the extra the extra lenses, the tripod, whatever. It was always there, ready to go, and I always had it. I don't think I ever went on a bike ride without it. And I photographed not just the bike thing, but I was photographing wildflowers and mushrooms and just actually photographed the trail as I went.
Documenting everything.
I was documenting everything. Now, of course, you could do it with a digital camera. Mm-hmm. You don't waste all the film, but boy, I mean, I had thousands of slides.
Wow. Do you still have them?
Yeah. I have a massive collection of slides that I go through about once every 10 years, you know. I amass quite a collection.
Cool. Maybe you should do your own book.
You know, people have come to me and said, you know, a coffee-style book with them, you know. Because there are a lot of, you know, I was able to capture not just the places, but the people, the events, and there were few and far between, and there weren't that many people doing it back then. You know, we were really a select group, you know. When we say we were the clunkers, you know, and the, there were the clunkers in Fairfax, and then there was the ballooners in Mill Valley, and the bombers in Larkspur. So,
so you had gangs.
And we kind of had little tribes, and we and I wasn't aware of the others, you know, and I don't know if they were aware of us.
Oh, wow.
And it wasn't until really Repack that we realized there were more of us. And then they started coming from Berkeley, and it was like, whoa, there are... You know, this was a couple of years after the advent of it. So we'd already pretty much established ourselves, you know, as clunkerers.
Yeah.
The Repack, just the idea of, you know, being able to challenge someone else and see how fast they can go compared to you, you know, on dirt. It was a real testosterone thing for these guys.
Did you compete?
I did compete a couple of times. I think I still hold the women's record.
Nice.
Which was 5.229, which is only a minute 20 seconds slower than Gary. So, I mean, it's, but after a couple of, you know, I literally had trouble keeping my feet on the pedals. My legs would shake so hard.
Oh, wow.
I was scared to death. It was terrifying.
Was it mostly downhill stuff?
Oh, it's all downhill.
It was all downhill.
Well, Repack is completely downhill.
Okay.
Yeah, you just go for it, you know, and just almost 2 miles. Completely, you know. There are some sections that are pretty treacherous, you know.
I can imagine.
Yeah. And of course, some people had some pretty scary accidents, and I didn't want to compromise myself after up to a point, you know. So then I started just hopping off my bike and taking photos at Camera Corner, you know. Just that was where all the action was.
Cool.
So, yeah.
Awesome. What was it like being, were you really the only female, or were there, in these other groups, were there like kind of one or two?
Not that I knew of. We had a couple of other women that would, Fred's wife kind of joined us for a couple of rides, but she really, really didn't like it. I mean, it wasn't really fair that we tried to initiate her, you know, by taking her up it. You know, that's just not fair on the hottest day of the summer, you know. So we weren't really thinking ahead for that one.
I think it's going to be fun. Come on.
There were a couple. We had a friend named Vince, and his wife, Carolyn, she rode with us occasionally. And then it wasn't really until Charlie had a girlfriend named Denise Caramagno, and she was pretty much... She had balls. She got into it, and she got into it. Well, because Charlie kind of, you know, encouraged her as well, which is a great thing because we needed some more women out there.
Yeah,
The longest time, it was just pretty much me. You know, I grew up in a big family. I had four brothers and three sisters, so mm-hmm. I gravitated towards the things the boys were always doing. You know, and I was, you know, I grew up as a tomboy, so. It didn't matter to me that there were other women or not. I was going to do it one way or the other.
And, yeah.
You know, when I first discovered it, I would just spend all day out there by myself exploring, you know, with my camera. And I had my maps, and it was like being an explorer. It was exactly what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Well, I grew up wanting to be a merchant marine. I wanted to, you know, travel, but the ocean and I don't get along, so that wasn't going to work.
Well, you got the mountains and stuff.
So it worked out perfectly, you know, because I had this vehicle, you know, essentially that was going to propel me into places that I really, really wanted to go. I'd wake up in the morning, look at the weather, and say, where am I going today?
You
know,
awesome.
What am I going to do today? How long do I have? You know, 5-6 hours, you know.
That's
sometimes
freedom,
I'd just be out there all day. One time I actually went on 3 different rides.
In the same day.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Day, and I rode up my hill 3 times in one day. My
nice.
Hill is way up there.
So you still live in the area?
Yeah, I still
you
live
grew
there.
Grew up here?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Berkeley, but been in Marin since 68.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen it change? I'm talking about the area, but also about kind of mountain biking in itself.
Well, obviously, back in the day, we had no idea what we were getting ourselves into. I'm thrilled to the max that it, because... In reality, the mountain bike happened right at the time the oil crisis was occurring, mm-hmm. and no one rode bikes. No one, really. I mean, unless you were a hardcore cyclist or, you know, just go into the corner market to grab a quart of milk or something, mm-hmm. people just didn't, you didn't see people riding bikes. So it just came along at the perfect time. And, you know, it's so functional.
Yeah, yeah.
So fat tires were a big plus, you know. It's just beefy bike, you know. You felt comfortable.
Yeah.
You could handle any kind of asphalt, concrete thing, you know.
Do you still ride now?
I'm riding again, yeah. I got back on my bike about a year ago.
Cool.
Yeah. So I had about a 10-year, I didn't get on it for 10 years, but I had ridden 30-plus years solid.
Wow.
Solid. There were probably... I could probably have counted on my hands the days I missed. You know? No, I mean, really, I was
That's amazing.
Pretty much obsessed.
cool. You know?
And it was, I've said the same thing to everyone I've ever been interviewed by. It saved so many psychiatrist bills. There's nothing quite like the mountain bike for just getting introspective mm-hmm. and dealing with any kind of issues you've got with yourself, because you're all by yourself,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
No matter how many people are around yeah. you, you're always by yourself in that regard. I'm kind of a diehard. I love my Breezer. So many memories on that bike.
Oh.
Yeah. I probably have had about 5 mountain bikes in my life. This was definitely my favorite.
Cool.
And I rode the original Breezer for so many years, and it never fit me, you know, and it was, like, way too big, and I think I put nearly 50,000 miles on it, though. Just
you made it work.
Yeah, I made it work. Yeah. Adapted it to me. You know, my roots are on the dirt, so I think that's probably where I'll be staying for a while.
Nice.
Sure, this is Jackie Phelan, and I'm talking at the Marin Museum of the Bicycle with Jen and my husband, Charlie, and you wanted an encapsulation of my getting started. And
yeah,
I was
your
using,
life in a nutshell.
It's easy to do. I had a teacher in high school that pointed out we'd spend a third of our lifetime energy earning to pay for a car, another third paying for a house, and I thought, when am I going to play Scrabble and go backpacking? Maybe I better not buy a car. Maybe I shouldn't try buying a house. Maybe I'll just ride a bike, rent, and exchange nanny services. And so I just started out by not buying a car and just was, like, way ahead of the pack financially.
Yeah.
Yeah. Somebody caught me at a stop sign in San Francisco and said, hey, you should try racing. I'll even drive you to your first race. So he drove me to my first race, which I did super well in. It was a collegiate race.
Were you riding really fast?
Well, he couldn't catch up to me yeah. until a stoplight. Or 6 stoplights
yes.
or whatever. And so he's just like, hey, you know, you could be
That's
racing.
That's amazing.
And I had, at the time, I was riding on a girl's Raleigh, you know, with the basket. And
yeah,
I had
yeah,
a toy
yeah.
duck, a plush little mallard on my big fat Bell biker helmet. Because people laughing at you can't say that they didn't see you.
Exactly.
And it's a sight gag anyhow, because you're cruising along through traffic and it might
and
look like there's
a
little duck moving smoothly through this Market Street. So Daryl got me racing. I met other people at the race. We became friends. I began doing collegiate racing and doing extremely well. And then tried the real thing, which is United States Cycling Federation. I think it's called USA Cycling now, but was really strong, but reviled because I was such a sketchy bike handler. It takes a while to learn how to ride at 20 miles an hour or 25 around a corner, handlebar to handlebar with other people.
Mm-hmm.
And since I was undroppable, that meant I could be in the middle of the mix any old time. And would you please take up a new sport? And at the time, we were putting together a team for me to race in the Zred Zinger Classic, and I was shamed into not doing it.
Oh,
even
no.
though the whole team was going to be built around me and my climbing abilities, I stayed home and wrote a couple of letters, one to the Swedish national champion, Tuula Gaara, and the other to a Dutch woman, American Carrie Peterson, who's American but moved to Holland and was a racer. Did you run into any problems in your first year of racing? And they both wrote back and said, yeah. They were,
wow.
You know, I just needed to know that it wasn't me.
You're not alone.
No, I just, yeah. And I wanted to be popular. Charlie, yeah. This is all too bloody familiar, right? Well, I'd heard of a faster tribe of fellows north of the Golden Gate Bridge, and so after a couple of flubs, I met Charlie, and we have been together ever since, which is
wow.
1982.
Awesome.
I was racing your bike, getting it out there.
So, Charlie, you were the builder?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I built 188 in my career. They're very sophisticated, heat-treated aluminum mountain bikes. Not just that, but they really were cutting edge in terms of figuring out the geometry and the frame design and stuff like that. So they're very advanced for their time. And if people could afford them, they could run on them.
Cool.
And they often did.
I saw there was one in the corner.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the one?
The red-tired one is Otto, and that's my bike. And then the one up above is CC Proto, which is was his first. You know, it's shiny and has drop bars.
Yeah.
It's pretty
yeah,
easy
that one.
To see. So that's Charlie. See how long the seat tube is
mm-hmm.
and how it's curved a little bit?
Yeah.
Long legs, long arms. Mine is a whole lot shorter in the head tube. And the seat doesn't stick way up like that. But anyway, I had a very light bike. I had 10 pounds less than everybody else at the time.
Because it was aluminium.
And had two chain rings, not three. I had toe clips. No one else used toe clips. They had flat pedals. So I was connected to the bike.
Combining kind of racing components with...
Right.
With mountain biking.
Well, yeah. A lot of people would say you couldn't get me to, like, tie myself onto my bike that way. And I go, that's fine. You know, see you at the races.
Yeah.
You can drive the bike much more efficiently.
Yeah,
right. And if you don't crash a lot, it's not like you're going to twist your ankle.
No, you can adjust.
So eventually, you know, Shimano came up with the ski binding style situation. But I like Charlie's toe clips better because you can wear ordinary shoes and tighten them and be in. Not ruin your ride because you forgot your shoes. And you don't have to buy new shoes every change of technology. Anyway, we had mass start races in those days, which were a little, you know, between 100 and 500 or 600 people stampedes with, mixed gender.
People starting at the same time.
Yes. That's called mass start.
That is a mass start.
A lot more fun.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You don't have to calculate who you beat. Just
get
look
out
at the
there.
Finish board and... You beat that many people.
Yeah.
You don't have to, like, go, okay, well, they left it. My wish was, you know, it was obvious people thought it was a men's game, and I knew it wasn't a men's game at all. I was an outlier for sure, but it wasn't, I don't know how to best put it, but I have read enough about women at the very front to know that I was going to be facing the usual disparagement and condescension. And then when it becomes ordinary, it's always been like that. That's always what happens. Is first you're, you know, kind of out of your mind, and then it becomes more mainstreamed, and then it was like it was always like this.
Yeah.
And I save all articles in those magazines to prove that I started off a whack job, and now it's nobody understands, you know, like the editor would just go, oh, shoot. Bickering about, you know, the women get blah, blah, blah.
Why are you making a big deal?
Well, I was taking notes, and things weren't so great for women in the beginning. They still aren't. Worldwide, women, you know, get short shrift. And after that, children and animals. But anyway, we're talking about women on bikes, and I thought that I could create a funny, safe environment with lots of tea and sweets and, you know, gab. Which constitutes
social
conviviality. Sure enough, you know, little five-year generations of women got better on bikes, stayed friends with each other. Then a new group of people would show up, and they made all be friends with each other. And, of course, the ones before were snobby about the ones after. I don't have that gene of disparaging latecomers, so I always have looked after the super new ones. But most humans, they can't help it. We're hardwired to like the familiar.
True.
So there's where I came up with patches and slogans and...
This is Wombat.
Secret handshakes. Yeah.
There's a secret handshake.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's the Marx Brothers.
It's under the leg.
Yeah. You know, the old Marx Brothers shake. And it was just so stupid. And I thought, I'm going to use that for something. I haven't gotten around to a decoder ring, but...
At Bike Kitchen in London, we have something called our Women and Gender Variant Night, which is our WAG night.
Mm-hmm.
And in the UK, WAG is a disparaging term for wives and girlfriends. And we decided to subvert it. And it means basically anyone on the gender spectrum, except for cis males, can come in. And we do twice a month lessons, classes on maintenance, because women are generally not welcome or made to feel welcome in workshop spaces.
Sure.
And so we're like, come in to the back door, come in and get your hands dirty and make mistakes, and it's okay. Because there's other women here who are going to look after you.
Right. A whole lot of dark art to the bicycle repair. I took a repair class because the teacher was teaching it because he wanted to lift the veil off the mystery of
the
bicycling.
That's exactly what I say. I call it pulling back the curtain.
Right.
You know, it's like, come back here.
Right. I think of it as the tent, the circus tent.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm just scooting women in for free where the barkers are turning them away at the ticket booth.
Come get in under here.
Right. I'm with the band. You've probably read the book by Frances Willard called Wheel Within a Wheel.
No.
It's required reading for your women.
Okay, Wheel Within a Wheel, guys. Get that.
She was the head of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, burned out back then. It was the biggest group of women, agglomeration of women in the world. She was ahead of it, burnt out. Her girlfriend invited her to stay a year in England, and a friend gave her a bike named Gladys, and she swore that at age 54 she would learn to ride that bike so that younger women would be encouraged. So I'm really just Frances Willard all over again, except I didn't start old, although 25 for starting racing was considered quite old then. We're going to try to get mountain biking to seem like the obvious use of, a woman's obvious favorite tool. It's a revolutionary tool.
I love mountain biking.
Self-empowerment. So that's my story.
Cool. Hey, it's Jenny, and I'm here with...
Joe Brees with the Marin Museum of Bicycling.
And I've asked Joe to pick out his top three or top five favorite exhibits here at the museum. So we're going to go through a bit of history here and learn something.
Well, I hope so. I hope you do. Maybe I will in the process. But what I have chosen are the very earliest days of the pedal bicycle. And this is in the late 19th century, and we have seven bikes, which really show the stepping stones in the evolution from a bike just with pedals on the front wheel, pedaling directly, to a bike that kind of looks like the basic profile of the bicycle we all love today. We have a bike from 1868.
Wow.
It's made in Paris. And it's made with wrought iron and wooden wheels.
Oh, God.
Wooden spoked wheels with iron tires.
This looks so uncomfortable.
Ah, in fact, it soon earned the appellation bone shaker because it was just rattle your bones.
So this is the original,
is
the bone shaker.
This is where we started with the pedal bicycle. And you'll see a crank attached to the front wheel. And you're going to go down the highway as far per pedal revolution as the circumference of the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
That's the size of the gear on the bike right there. And
is that the brake?
Yeah, and it even has a brake on the rear wheel, which is attached by a rawhide cord all the way to the handlebar through pulleys, and you can spool up the handlebar to wrap that rawhide around and pull on this block and tackle system to apply the rear brake to a wooden shoe against the iron tire to slow you down, hopefully, with a little anticipation, perhaps. And hey, you got to start somewhere,
yeah,
right? And
yeah,
this is pretty
true.
Much
you
the
start
beginning.
Somewhere.
This company, Michaud and Company, is the first commercial maker of a pedal bicycle, and they're just 3 years into the first production of such a vehicle. And it's wrought iron hammered together, red hot in a forge. This is the very earliest days before steel was even available.
Wow.
So, they made thousands. Their competitors made thousands, and it was a rip-roaring deal in the late 1860s, including international races, 85 miles long, pedaling these bikes that are probably most all over 75 pounds each.
Oh, my God. So. I'm so glad we've had progress.
Yeah, I don't know how far this would have continued on, but it did, it actually, the hub of cycling shifted to Coventry, England, after the Franco-Prussian War of 1870, and there they took it up in Coventry. Now, this next bike here, it's a penny farthing, a high wheel bike.
It's beautiful.
And it is a prime example of a high wheel bike.
Mm.
And it's because it's a Rudge. And Daniel Rudge is the very guy who figured out the basic ingredients for a ball bearing.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and on his bicycle, his patent of 1878, you'll see on the main bearings there, is the bearing that is considered the great granddaddy of all ball bearings in the world.
Amazing.
Yeah, not just in the bike industry, everywhere.
Wow.
And this is what our world turns on largely today.
Oh my gosh.
And it started right here with the bicycle, because the bicycle was the perfect scale of vehicle to develop the ball bearing. And there was this amazing craze because the bicycle was coming up in the world. And a locomotive, by the way, doesn't have ball bearings. The force from a locomotive would crush ball bearings. So like I say, this is the perfect scale of vehicle.
Cool. And is this an example of...
Yeah, of what a ball bearing is. It's simply a series of wheels inside a wheel to roll effortlessly.
Beautiful.
Where before that, you just had what was a plain journal, if you can imagine a simple bolt going through the crank spindle, and then around that would just be a bushing, just a solid chunk of bronze, really. Maybe have some oil running between it, but it doesn't roll anything like a ball bearing.
And this is sealed?
This is
loose?
A modern ball bearing. This is maybe from 1950 or so. But
where's this one from?
Oh, it's about the similar vintage, but it's just showing you the basic ideas of a ball. Even the when they were first making those ball bearings spherical, they were cutting them on lathes, and it was quite a lengthy process. But some clever man in Schweinfurt, Germany, Heinrich Fischer, figured out how to make these balls by the millions per day, by with this clever rilling plates, and that changed the whole deal. Everybody was putting ball bearings everywhere after that. It really brought the price down quite a bit. When you look at one of these penny farthing bikes, I'm sure they're plenty where you are.
everywhere.
Oh, everywhere. Everybody's on a high wheel bike, aren't they?
Yeah.
If you do happen to come across one, maybe at the Coventry Museum, they have a smattering of them. But you'll notice that the wheel, the driving wheel, the main wheel on the bike, the wheel that made them called the wheel, doesn't look a whole lot different from our wheels and our bicycles today. They have tangential spokes. They have J-pull spokes.
They have
spoke nipples so you can true the wheel easily. Those were ideas that just came in a few years before 1886 when this Rudge was made.
Cottered cranks.
Yet there's one real difference between a high wheel bike and the bikes we ride today. Even if the wheel does look the same, when you look at a penny farthing, it doesn't look anything like what we're on. But they sit on the bike in the same relationship as we do today. That is, set back from the cranks. Not direct. We don't sit directly on top of the cranks. We're set back at an angle to the cranks. But in their case, their feet are on the very fulcrum point of the front wheel. And you, if you're sprinting and leaning forward and want to go really fast, you're on the rivet. Well, you run the risk of teetering over that fulcrum point and landing on your head. I think it's where the term header comes from, from one of these high wheel penny farthings. Yeah, so what came after this, of course, is the safety cycle. Because the high wheel bikes were
anything but
safe. And so early 1880s was the high point of tricycles. There were many configurations made, and those clever people in Coventry, like James Starley, were figuring out how to make them better and better. And James Starley actually had women in mind when he came up with the safety, because in the Victorian era and the clothing that women were supposed to wear back then, they were very cumbersome, tight-fitting, tight-corseted, tight-waisted, impossible clothes, that where women could not ride a high-wheel bike. They could not straddle a high-wheel bike. So Starley came up with this clever design where the driving wheel is on one side to the left, and the steering wheels or the turning wheels are on the right, operated by a central lever to turn both wheels simultaneously. And women learned just as much freedom as men riding cycles, and soon came up with what was called rational dress. Okay, and of course they were immediately banished from all the tea houses in England, because this was scandalous, the audacity of challenging our social mores. And because of the freedom of cycling that everybody just couldn't help themselves but have, really cycling transcended social mores, and it really had a big hand in the emancipation of women that went right on through the latter part of the 19th century and up to the time of the right to vote, the whole suffrage movement.
Yeah.
And it largely generated from this craze of cycling in the late 19th century.
It was a vehicle for revolution.
That's right. Very good. Very good. Now, the next bike that came along, and as clever as Starley was with his two-track tricycle, one track is going to be better. It's going to be less expensive. It's going to be lighter.
Yeah.
It's going to be easier to wend your way, especially down a rough road. Only one track to keep your mind on. And it's the roller chain, or specifically the bush roller chain, that made the safety bicycle possible.
Can I touch it?
Yes, you may.
It's huge.
Yeah, yeah.
Compared with what we have.
Like they say, you got to start somewhere. And that is, in fact, a Reynolds change that you see right there.
Is that original?
And it was Hans Reynolds who came up with this idea, a Swiss immigrant to Manchester, England, who, with Starley, with James Starley, figured out this bush and roller system. It's not just a simple chain. It's the bush roller chain today is still the most efficient method of transmitting power known.
How do you feel about belt drive?
It's not quite as efficient, but it is cleaner, and I ride bikes with belt drive. In fact, I rode one down here today. Yeah, but yeah, this in fact is a Reynolds change that you see right there. And now you're able to pedal from a remote place, no longer attached, say, to the front wheel to drive the bike and sitting above it like we do. They've moved you and those pedals back on the bicycle to where a seat on a bicycle is today, and no longer are you perched high up over that fulcrum point. You're well behind it, and you're less likely to go over the handlebars, right? And with this transmission, in the same position where we pedal on a bicycle today, you're able to now gear it up through a big wheel, big chain wheel in front and a small one in the back to make it so that driving wheel does not have to be nearly as big as it was. It can be maybe half the size to go the same distance down the highway for every pedal revolution.
So this is fixed as well?
Yeah, in fact, all these bikes on this 19th century deck are fixed.
We've got a front brake here.
That's right, push rod front brake on the front wheel, on the front tire. It's a, they're still solid rubber tires.
Wow.
Perhaps the only downside to the new safety design was now the spokes were only half the length of what they used to be on the penny farthing. And that was suspension. In a wire tension wheel, the hubs hang from the top of the wheel, and those long, slender steel spokes are suspension.
So
and now you only had half as much comfort, right? And they're all grabbing their rears going, oh my gosh, because they're still on these hard rubber tires. And so the frame designers are curving the tubing in the frame and the fork blades and, of course, the saddle rails. To make it more compliant. And so, and it still wasn't
vertically
good enough
compliant.
Because of the tire. So what they did next was articulated suspension. That is, the rear of the bike frame and the front of the bike frame were separate from each other, and there was a bearing around the crank spindle so that the swing arm, that rear half of the bike, could rotate around that crank spindle to give you 2 to 3 inches of suspension travel that springs, like this, these big torsion springs here, could control that movement with to give you this articulated frame. 100 years before the mountain bike.
I was going to say, is this the precursor to...
This is, and many makers made full suspension bikes, front and rear, and because they were still on the hard rubber tire, the solid rubber tire.
That is front suspension.
And I should point out, this is the American Rambler.
Yeah.
Okay, this is, for those with a few more years of wisdom on yourselves, you might remember American Motors and Rambler cars. This is the American Rambler, the progenitor of those two car companies.
Oh,
and
wow.
Five of the bicycles that we show on this deck here went on to manufacture cars.
Cars.
It's the same brain trust. You know, these are the baby steps toward later technologies. And even the Wright brothers were bicycle builders before flying at Kitty Hawk. Around the corner here, we've got an example of front suspension.
Front suspension.
And this is right when John Boyd Dunlop is figuring out the air-filled pressurized pneumatic tire like we have today. It's kind of like we have today. And he was a veterinary surgeon in Ireland. I think he had the biggest practice in Ireland at the time.
What?
Yeah, and he had access to surgical tubing. Okay, rubber tubing. And one day his son complains of a rough ride on his tricycle, and dad comes to the rescue. Oh, I can put that tube, glue it together into a circle, poke a valve stem into it, mount it onto a spare bicycle wheel, wrap canvas around the whole mess, the rim and essentially that inner tube, and then he pumped it up with a soccer pump, a football pump, and found it, and then rolled out one of these new wheels of his and the old wheel side by side, rolled them down the street, and was astounded with how far the new pneumatic tire went and how it bounded down the street. And he thought of a bicycle racing friend of his, and he built a set of wheels for him. And that guy started winning everything, and everybody had to have that. And it just sent what was this huge craze of cycling into the stratosphere. And, you know, this became kind of the darling of society, and everybody was really digging bikes in this golden age of cycling of the 1890s. Yeah, it was quite a moment.
Amazing.
So, and now you finally had pneumatic tires, suspension right on your wheels.
Yeah, wooden rims.
And on wooden ribs in this case. And now you could streamline the frame down to this simple diamond-shaped structure, like kind of like we ride today.
Yeah.
And no longer did you really need the articulated frame, because now you had suspension right at the roadway where it does the most good with a voluminous pneumatic tire. Pneumatic wheel. And so here you have, by 1894, you have the basic form of a bicycle today.
Yeah.
In profile, it's not a whole lot different from the bikes most of us ride for getting around. And, and it's not because these guys had reached perfection at this point.
Mm.
It's because from this point onward, people would have other vehicles and other ways of getting around to focus, to apply their attentions to. And where competition had absolutely improved the breed up to this point and made all these amazing changes, from this point onward, racing would be more about the athlete and less about the technology.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is why bicycles look as they do today. It kind of stopped in about 1900, and it's really artificial racing. You know, the bikes that we are on, the reason that it's such is because it's about the athlete, not so much about the technology. Not that there aren't great differences in a bicycle of today, but the basic form is such because the rule books mandated it.
Interesting.
Gets you to the here where we are today, essentially.
Yeah.
And I should add that the UCI recently hinted, this is UCI is the Union Cyclist International, the world sanctioning body for all things bicycle racing, and they just recently hinted that they might be interested in giving back to humanity once again, you know, by developing a bicycle through racing for everybody, where because bicycling has, for so many decades, has been about the athlete,
mm-hmm.
not about the technology. We haven't seen so much. So
because UCI has been imposing rules on what kind of bikes
I mean, the UCI and
so, like, the whole disc brake debacle kind of thing. Or,
well, that's a detail of it, but there are plenty of designs that have been set by the way.
Or, like, Graham O'Brien couldn't race his bike.
Yeah, something like that. Or even a Y bike. Like, in 1995, Trek came out with this beautiful design, this Y frame. I'm not talking about the mountain bike version, but the road bike one, where you had the basic structure of the frame going from the head tube to the rear axle, and you could stomp on that bike, and it was super stiff. And at the same time, only a beam went out horizontally to
the
saddle.
Oh, that weird
looking.
So
vertically, that gave you compliancy, a smoother ride, while laterally and torsionally, you were on this really cool sprinting frame. Well, to the UCI, that did not look like a bicycle, and therefore, it was outlawed. And Trek stopped making it.
See.
Yeah, so things like that, maybe those can come back. There's a lot to be said for the basic configuration of you on a bicycle. You're like a cat on a bicycle,
mm-hmm.
and when something is coming in toward you, you can hop out of the way.
Yeah.
But maybe a recumbent, not so much. You're like a sack of potatoes. Not that there aren't good things about recumbents, but the upright safety bicycle, if you will, is a really great design. So go out and have fun on yours once the daylight hits.
It's Alex. I'm here to finish up the podcast. If you like what we do, like us on SoundCloud, rate us on iTunes, and don't forget to subscribe. Do you know somebody who likes cycling and podcasts? Then recommend our podcast, because everybody appreciates it. Until next time, bye!
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.